want to thank everybody who stopped by the WKAR broadcast booth at the Grand American Fish Rodeo last Saturday, by the way. A belated thank you. Rubbed shoulders with a lot of fishermen participating in the fishing contest that took place all day long, and we enjoyed some live music at the first Grand American Fish Rodeo, really a celebration of all things water here in Michigan and in Lansing. That, of course, means the Grand River. So many thanks to those of you who stopped by. It was a lot of fun. Later on this hour on Current State, a look at the particular challenges faced by the LGBT community regarding health. There are challenges there. We will explore them. Also, a look back a half century ago this Saturday, the murder of three civil rights workers rocked the country and the world down in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Freedom Summer. We look back at Freedom Summer coming up later this hour with Lynn Jondahl, our special guest. And we'll tell you more about an event related to Freedom Summer, which I think you're going to be interested in as well. Tomorrow night here at WKAR. The discussion over reforms to the Lansing Board of Water and Light has continued in recent days. One topic is whether to extend the contract of embattled General Manager Peter Lark. A BWL committee has recommended another year for Lark. However, some critics have repeated their view that Lark should go after the utility's botched response to last December's widespread storm-related power outages. Officials are also weighing whether to expand representation on the BWL Board of Commissioners. Last week, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero proposed a framework for expanding the board. For his response to these and other recent BWL developments, Current State welcomes back Vice Chair of the Utilities Board of Commissioners, Dennis Lowney. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Last week, the Board of Commissioners, a committee, I think the HR committee.
That's correct.
Voted 3-1. To recommend General Manager Lark be reappointed as GM for another year. That decision will go to the full board. You're not a member of that committee, as I understand it. You're maybe an alternate.
That's correct.
But the final decision, will go to the full board next month. What do you think of the committee's decision to recommend Mr. Lark for another year?
Well, I did sit in a closed session meeting that we had with the general manager. And there was a lot of concern and a lot of issues discussed at that time. It was a lengthy discussion. And I think the message was clear to the general manager that there were problems that occurred last year. But I think when you evaluate an employee, you have to look at their body of work. Consistently, it was noted that up until that point, the general manager had been doing a good job. He was lauded and the board had won numerous awards in regards to the new power plant, in regards to reliability and such. So I think to that degree, you tried to look at a person over the length of period that they were being evaluated on. And so I think based on that decision, there were mistakes made, but it didn't warrant eliminating or not renewing the general manager's contract.
Okay. I think it's clear the utility's response to the ice storm and Peter Lark's performance in particular has created a faction that won't be satisfied unless he leaves. And this group continues to be heard. Sandy Zirkel, the board chairwoman, agrees with you. She said he should be evaluated on lots more than just the utility's response to the ice storm. But cynics end up pointing out that events like the chili cook-off, which Ms. Zirkel said ought to be part of the review, they have trouble including an event like that in Mr. Lark's evaluation. Well, how do you respond?
And I would agree with the cynics in that sense. I mean, the way I looked at evaluating the general manager, because all the Board of Commissioners did, we did an evaluation, we submitted that, and then the HR committee reviewed those. And then we had the opportunity to sit down with the general manager in a closed session and really kind of drill down on some of the details and some of the concerns we had. So
the HR committee got feedback from all the members of the Board of Commissioners.
Correct.
Before they made their recommendation.
Correct. Okay. So it wasn't specifically just them, but they were the only members that were part of the process to officially renominate him.
Okay.
But responding to your question in regards to the cynics, managing a utility is a difficult task, and certainly there were some mistakes made during the ice storm and the crisis. But I think what I found when I had to evaluate the general manager was there were a lot of good things he had done. There were a lot of things he had put in place. Now, the buck stops with him, and I don't disagree with that. But I think there's also measures that we can put in place to make sure that those things don't happen and that we can put him to a certain degree of saying, these are performance measures we want you to meet. And if you can't meet these, then we really seriously have to look at it. One of the other things I considered is if we didn't renominate him, we were going to have to do a search and we were going to have to bring another person in, look at candidates. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but what I'm saying is there's a lot of work that we need to do already based on the recommendations of the CRT, the MPSC, and the internal review that was done. And I think the general manager is doing those things. I think he's changed his management structure. I think everyone wants our utility to be a better utility, and we're making those changes to do so.
Do you know how you'll be voting next month?
I will be voting to reappoint the general manager.
Okay. And when the rubber hits the road, what's the deciding factor there? You would tip the scales in his favor in terms of the constructive impact he has had over a longer period of years.
Correct.
How difficult was it to come to that decision?
Well, it was difficult because to me there were certain things like his trip to New York that just were inexcusable. I mean, in a time of crisis, you don't leave. You're a public servant, and it seemed to me that was not an appropriate thing to do. But I also look at how he's responded to this crisis and the changes that he's helping to put in place. And it's not a stonewalling. It's really an acceptance and an embracing of making sure we are going to be a better utility. So I look at it that over the last 7 years, he's really accomplished a lot of good things, and he's led us on a good course. The new power plant, we're one of the first plants in 50 years to be built in this state. And he's moving a lot of the facilities out of the floodplain that are in the floodplain, especially with the way our temperatures and our weather is changing. We had to consider that some of our facilities were built in the floodplain, which a lot were throughout the state, because they needed to be close to the rivers and such. But what that does then is that also ensures that we're going to have reliable power. So if there is a 100-year flood, that it's not going to impact our facilities and we can still deliver the services to our customers. And that's a massive undertaking when you look at where a lot of our properties and facilities were located.
We're talking with Dennis Lowney, who is a commissioner on the Lansing Board of Water and Light Board of Commissioners, the vice chair of that body. Do you think your opinion is shared by a majority of the people on the board? In terms of reappointing, extending Peter Lark's contract a year?
I would say so. I think the board will vote to reappoint the general manager. Personally, myself, and I know there's a couple other members that had some severe concerns. We kind of evaluated Peter in two phases. One was before the storm, and two was the storm and afterwards.
It's like the world changed.
Right. I mean, it really did. So looking at that realistically, I do think there's some things that we are going to ask of him in his contract, some current changes that I would like to see, and I know others would like to see, that kind of put him on notice that, if this behavior or this management style does not change, that, we want to make sure that's going to be reflected in how you're going to be compensated.
Management style? I mean, what does that mean?
That might not have been the right term, but I guess management in general. Again, and I refer back to those recommendations. I really feel it's important that we had a great group of volunteers from the CRT, MPSC, and our internal report that was done that really gave us a roadmap as to where we need to go and what we need to do to be a better utility. So I want those, as committee of the whole chair, I want those reported at committee of the whole. I want to see a progress. We've got a timeline of when they'll be implemented. If they can't be implemented, why? I really want to put us to task as a utility to make sure that the work that was done by others does not go to waste.
How would you assess the utility's performance? How would you assess Peter Lark's performance post-CRT report? Are you more encouraged than discouraged?
Well, I think initially I would say, and many people noted this, there was it seemed a little bit uncaring. It seemed a little bit that he wasn't genuine. I think some of that was the breadth of information and the crisis that kind of overwhelmed him. Now that he's gotten his feet back on the ground and he's moved forward, I'm impressed. We've implemented several things that were not in existence just 6 months ago. So I think Peter is doing the correct things that need to be done for us to be a better utility, and he's the leader of that utility. So I would expect nothing less from him, and that's one of the reasons why I am going to vote to reappoint him, because I do think how someone handles a challenge and then how they move on from it is important, and that's a sign of a good leader, and I think Peter is doing that. Now, I know that may not satisfy some of the cynics or the critics, but I do think what I've said to people is, give us time to show that these changes are going to be made. So there will be more ice storms. There will be winter storms. We will lose power at times. But we are going to be there for you. You're going to know it. And we're not going to respond the way we did last December. We're a better utility, and we're going to take care of our customers, and it's going to be a reliable utility.
Let's look at another aspect of this. Lansing Mayor Virge Brunero last Friday proposed a new framework for representation on the BWL board that he says he'll put before City Council soon. It would create three new non-voting members, one each from East Lansing and Delta Township. Those persons would serve four-year terms. The third would rotate among Delhi, Meridian, Lansing, and DeWitt townships. Those are the four largest remaining townships served by the BWL. What do you make of the mayor's plan?
I think it's a good proposal. It's a starting point, I think, and I think the mayor put a lot of thought into it. When you look at the Board of Water and Light and when it was initially created, it was created in the city of Lansing through the city charter. It expanded to provide power and utility service to outer areas. And I think we've been very reliable. We've had at times the fourth lowest cost in the state. So we're an affordable, reliable utility. And what the mayor did was he looked at that investment that's been made, and he looked at where we've expanded with our customer base and said that we need some representation in those areas. And I think he listened to the people. It was difficult in some ways because as a board, we don't make the decisions in regards to expansion. So in some ways, I look at it that we have a board that we're going to work with, and it's up to the mayor and the city council to decide who's going to be members of that and how that process will work.
You refer to it as a good starting point. Have you had enough time to think about how you might tweak the mayor's plan?
Well, I'm not necessarily in favor of tweaking the mayor's plan, but I think it changes everything, having new representatives come on the board, because they're going to bring new knowledge, they're going to bring new information and representation of some of those customers. I've often said that we represent all our customers, but I certainly recognize during the storm that Delta Township and East Lansing residents and others that were not in the downtown Lansing area were impacted. And when I went to those hearings, I said to them, if you need representation, contact me. Here's my phone number. Here's my email. This will give them that direct conduit, a direct liaison to work with. So I think it's a great first step.
Have you thought about when this arrangement might unfold? I mean, it means revising the city charter, which I'm led to believe would probably take until later in the year, maybe new members, even if it all went smoothly, new members until maybe the first of next year or thereabouts?
I was, just thinking off the top of my head, and I don't want this to sound like it comes from the mayor or from the board, but my personal opinion was I think it will take some time. The mayor's going to introduce it. It'll be brought up by city council. And that's where I say I think it's a good first step, because the mayor's proposing this. It's going to be discussed, and then actually to implement it is another step.
The Public Service Commission report came out, and one of its recommendations was that everybody on the board, on the Board of Commissioners have, quote, utility experience. Good idea. What's your
response?
Oh, sure. I mean,
you want people on any board to have some experience in the field that they're going into. I think it makes a.
Not everybody has that experience on the board now, though. Correct.
That's correct. But I do think there's some educational tools. The American Public Power Association has annual conferences and seminars. I'm currently going through a board governance certification process. So that I can learn some of the proper ways that utilities are governed by their boards. So other members have chosen other ways in educating themselves. So while I think it's important that you can get someone who has utility experience, sometimes those people aren't available. I think the other thing that's important is, too, is you want people that also represent our customers. So you want those people that are tied into the community and can talk to people and find out, you know, what's your opinion? What's going on? I think that was valuable to me, that I had a lot of resources I could go to during the ice storm, and a lot of people weren't happy. So I took that view when I came back to the board and looking at this issue and really said, you know, we need to listen to what our customers are saying.
Dennis Lowney is vice chair of the Board of Commissioners for the Lansing Board of Water and Light. Dennis, we appreciate you making yourself available as this story continues to unfold. Many thanks.
Thank you, Mark. You guys have a great day.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us here on Tuesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. The World Health Organization and Pan American Health Organization recently expressed concern about the lack of knowledge of the health problems of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people. Current state's Melissa Benmark joins me now for more. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. Many people in these groups are essentially invisible to the healthcare community for a variety of reasons, including fear of negative consequences if they're honest with their health providers about their status. And to try and understand more about what's going on, I spoke with Gary Harper. He's a professor in the Department of Health Behavior and Health Education in the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. And he says the problem goes way beyond the Americas.
I would expand that to the world. So I would say it's beyond just the Americas. I think in general we know very little about health issues for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender individuals, or LGBT as is commonly used. I think part of that has to do with the amount of stigma and discrimination that still exists around both sexual orientation and gender identity. And I think it's important to differentiate those two, because we often put LGBT together under the umbrella of sexual and gender minorities, but there is a very big difference, because when we're talking about lesbian, gay, and bisexual individuals, that has to do with sexual orientation, so who they're attracted to, who they may have sexual relations with, romantic relationships, desires with, whereas for transgender individuals, that's more of an issue of gender. So that's an individual who does not identify with their birth gender. And so even though we put those together, I think it's still important, especially around health issues, to differentiate between sexual orientation and gender identity.
Right.
And I think that because there is so much discrimination just generally, and I think a lack of understanding, because it is something that many people are uncomfortable talking about because of the discrimination that exists. And then that translates into a lack of open discussion in research settings, in practice settings, and other places like that, where we typically would talk about health issues and explore health issues.
One of the things that occurred to me in reading up on doing this interview was that if I were a doctor or if I were conducting a study, you know, they usually have you fill out your race information, your marital status, stuff like that. But I would feel, I guess, like, why would I ask someone if they were gay or straight first? I mean, I would feel almost like it was like a, you know, like I was just being discriminatory or, frankly, just nosy doing a thing like that. So how could the medical profession improve health information gathering for LGBT people without it being or seeming discriminatory?
Right. Well, I think that there has been a push to collect both sexual orientation and gender identity information on more large-scale national surveys and in you know, things like doctor's offices, other places like that, and to make it just part of routine care. But people would always have the option, if they choose, to not mark that. Now, one of the things that's a tricky issue is that, you know, in the United States, you can still legally be discriminated against based on sexual orientation and, to some extent, gender identity. So there are no large-scale federal protections. Now, there are protections within different municipalities, within different states. But in terms of federal protection, there aren't large-scale protection across all forms of discrimination based on sexual orientation or on gender identity. So that's what makes it a tricky issue, is that if you would put that on a survey, you would put that on an intake form in a doctor's office, there is the potential for discrimination. Now, the reason why that's important is because that if that's a salient part of your identity and that impacts who you may be having romantic relationships, who you may be having sexual relationships with, that's important to know, especially around primarily sexual health issues. But then also we know that for certain groups, for instance, lesbian women are at higher risk of breast cancer because they have lower rates of pregnancy, and pregnancy serves as a protective factor against breast cancer. It may also give the clinician avenues for questions around things like substance use, cigarette smoking, other types of issues like that, or even around mental health issues. So if someone is LGBT identified, they may feel isolated and they may be experiencing depression, but they may not come right out and talk to their provider and say, oh, I'm depressed. Because a lot of the different symptoms of depression and even anxiety can manifest themselves physiologically. So you may have sleep disturbances, you may have weight loss, weight gain, you may have a lack of concentration, other things which, if you don't know the context and the background, you might assume that it's more of a physiological health issue, but there may be either a significant mental health origin or a significant mental health relationship going on.
There are places, you said at the beginning of this interview, extending that to the world, the lack of information about LGBT people. But there are places in the world and in the Americas where it is criminal to be homosexual or perceived that way. And also, you know, really not all that long ago, 1990 was when the WHO eliminated that as a disorder. It seems like there's a lot of catching up to do.
Right. Yeah, we definitely have a lot of catching up to do. So that's why, you know, interviews such as this that you're doing are great. And there needs to be more public recognition and public understanding of why we even need to be talking about LGBT health issues. So, for instance, a lot of people don't have an idea about some of the health issues which may be more predominant among LGBT individuals as opposed to other individuals. It's really a very difficult situation, and that's why, you know, some of us, especially who work in international and global settings, realize that what we need to do too, besides doing more research and working on issues related to LGBT people and their health issues, is we also need to work on human rights issues. Because
right.
if we don't have basic human rights for LGBT people, we can't even talk about access to health care. So with some of the work that I'm doing in Kenya, we work in collaboration with local organizations that do human rights issues for LGBT folks, because you really can't talk about LGBT health without talking about LGBT human rights.
So people traditionally, I think, consider the biggest health crisis to be facing the LGBT community, which of course is not just one community. It's many communities, but people tend to think of HIV/AIDS. Would you agree with that as being the biggest crisis, or do you see other things emerging that concern you more or equally?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I think that HIV is still a very significant issue in this country for certain populations within the broader LGBT community. So one thing we see in the United States is that when we look at young Black, gay, and bisexual men and other young men who have sex with men, the rates of HIV among that population are continuing to rise. whereas we've seen a leveling off among a lot of other populations in the United States, for young black gay men, we're still seeing increases in rates of HIV infection. There's been a lot of different potential explanations for that. It's not that they're having higher rates of sexual behavior, because when you compare that to other populations, they aren't. A lot of it has to do with the fact that there's higher rates of HIV within sexual networks, and those sexual networks are smaller, so the disease spreads much quicker. So that's still a big issue. But there are other issues. There's a lot of mental health issues, and not that there's anything inherently wrong in being LGBT, which then makes you have mental health issues, but it's, again, the stigma and discrimination that can lead individuals to suffer from anxiety, depression, isolation. As I mentioned before, for women, there's issues around breast cancer, and there's much higher rates for lesbian women. We also see that for transgender individuals, especially those that may be on hormone therapy, if they're not receiving that in a medical environment that is safe and sound, because sometimes what we see, especially in large urban centers, is that transgender individuals may be going to doctors who are providing services out of hotel rooms or other places like that, right, where they're getting really cheap injections and things like that. There's a lot of other health issues. We need to move beyond just talking about HIV, because I think you're absolutely right. I think the general public still thinks that HIV is the primary health issue, and that's the only health issue that we see higher rates. And some individuals, I think, even think that we don't have to worry about HIV anymore because we have such good treatment now.
I was going to ask you about that, and I didn't want to minimize it, but again, I think a lot of people are like, oh yeah, well, there's the drug cocktail, you know.
Right, yeah. I think the interesting thing that we see, though, is that if you think about the populations that are most impacted, so young black gay men who may be afraid to go to their health care provider and may have different issues going on in their life, which may prohibit them from taking their medication on a regular basis, what happens is that some of these individuals are still dying of AIDS. I still do work, a lot of work in Chicago, which is where I was before I came here to University of Michigan. And at the county hospital, we still see young men that are dying of AIDS-related illnesses, which is almost unheard of among adult populations typically in the United States because of the medication. But if you think about it, if you're, you know, a young man and no one knows that you're gay or knows that you're having sex with other men, you may be less likely to get tested. Even if you get tested, you may be less likely to seek treatment, because if you're living with your family or you're living with friends and people like, hey, what are those pills?
Right, yeah, found your meds, you know, lying around.
What, right,
yeah.
Then that's a really easy way to not only disclose your status, but also disclose your sexual orientation. So because of all those barriers and because of all that stigma, what we see is that young black gay men who are living with HIV are less likely to get consistent treatment and to be adherent to their medications and to their doctor's appointments. So even though, yes, for people who have resources, for people who have social support, for people who have all of the other aspects that help people to stay healthy, it's not as detrimental as it used to be. But for the populations that are most impacted, it still is extremely detrimental. And we still see young men that are dying in their early 20s of AIDS-related illnesses because they get infected early in their sexual lives. And then the disease progresses if they are not getting the access to treatment that they really need.
Dr. Gary Harper, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Most people are aware of the sexy greenhouse gas, CO2. Fewer know of its co-culprit, nitrous oxide. The third largest greenhouse gas, after carbon dioxide and methane, nitrous oxide is released naturally from soil, However, the increased use of nitrogen fertilizer in agriculture has resulted in a rise of nitrous oxide emissions. A new Michigan State University study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggests using more precise applications of nitrogen fertilizer can maintain farmers' yields while decreasing greenhouse gas emissions. Neville Miller, Senior Research Associate at Michigan State University and study contributor, joins us with more. Neville Miller, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mike.
For starters, what does nitrogen do to growing green things exactly? Why do growers use nitrogen-based fertilizers?
Well, nitrogen, as you probably most people know, is an essential nutrient, and crops and plants need it to grow to reach their maximum potential. So we need nitrogen. Wherever that comes from is a bigger question. Does it come from the atmosphere? Some plants fix nitrogen. Some plants get nitrogen through their roots. But a lot of crops that we grow these days, obviously corn is a big crop in the Midwest, they require nitrogen, and that comes predominantly from synthetic fertilizer applications to the crop. A good amount of nitrogen is good for the crop. It maximizes yield, but excess nitrogen applied can be then processed in the soil to produce this greenhouse gas you mentioned, nitrous oxide. It can also be lost in other forms to soil water through nitrate leaching, for instance.
How common is it globally to use nitrogen?
Oh, it's exceptionally common. I mean, most of the main grain crops you can think of require nitrogen fertilizer. Fertilizer is applied ubiquitously around the globe, and that's why this research that we looked at was looking at nitrogen fertilizer applications in as many systems we could find throughout the globe to try to define a relationship between the amount of nitrogen applied to the soil and the amount of nitrous oxide emissions released from the soil as a result of that fertilizer application.
And generally, how does nitrogen impact water systems?
Well, I mean, it may leach. If there are excess nitrogen in the soil which isn't taken up by the crop, that nitrogen in the form of nitrate typically can be leached and lost into the groundwater, which can then flow into streams, headwater streams, larger rivers, and then obviously into larger water bodies. A lot of people have probably heard of maybe hypoxia in the Gulf of Mexico. That's an example of excess nutrients, including nitrogen, which cause issues way downstream of where the actual nitrogen is applied in the farm field.
And tell us here also, does it figure into climate change then as well? Explain the connection there.
Absolutely, yes. This gas that we've talked about, this nitrous oxide gas, as you mentioned, is a very important greenhouse gas. It's actually roughly 300 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in its ability to warm the atmosphere on a per molecule basis. And this nitrous oxide gas is produced naturally in the soil from microbial processes. But as I say, when there's an excess amount of nitrogen in the soil that the crop doesn't need, then those microbes in the soil are very happy to see that nitrogen, and they produce more of this gas, nitrous oxide, through some of the processes that they conduct. And obviously that leads to larger increases in the atmosphere and more global warming.
Your research focuses on how more precise measurements of nitrogen-based fertilizer could help slow global warming. Are planters are too generous in their applications then?
Yeah, I mean, this is not to say that farmers obviously go out and producers deliberately apply huge amounts of nitrogen. I mean, they're obviously, they want to manage their farm as efficiently and as possible with regards to their economics as well as the environment. But yes, I mean, in general, farmers may tend to use nitrogen fertilizer as a type of insurance, as a hedging for the best years where the rainfall and the climate is ideal for the crop to grow. And those years don't come along very frequently. So a lot of the time there is excess nitrogen in the system which can be lost either to groundwater and nitrate leaching or to nitrous oxide and other species of nitrogen in the atmosphere and the water. So more precisely really means a better overall management. It may mean reduced rates, which is the most important factor for reducing nitrous oxide in the atmosphere, but it also may mean a better timing of the fertilizer when the crop actually needs it, when it's growing. It may mean a better placement of the fertilizer in the soil or on the surface, whatever's best for that particular crop. So it's an overall best management practice with regards to nitrogen, including and predominantly the better nitrogen rate.
Are growers sufficiently aware of the impact that nitrogen has when they use it? I mean, can you generalize about that?
I think Most producers would be aware of nitrogen with regards to its loss probably to water and nitrate leaching, particularly if they're in zones which have, for instance, poor water quality, poor drinking water quality. They may be aware of large nitrogen losses through that route. A lot of the Midwest, as you probably know, is tile drained, so a lot of this nitrate that's in the soil can be rapidly flushed from their system and obviously flushed into rivers and larger water bodies. Less, I'm certain, are aware of the impact on the atmosphere with regards to greenhouse gas nitrous oxide, although we have a lot of initiatives at the moment at Michigan State University and other universities with colleagues here who are trying to, you know, disseminate information through MSU Extension and other organizations and people.
We're talking with Neville Miller, who has been studying the impact of nitrogen-based fertilizers on the environment here at Michigan State University. For the past several years, MSU research has focused on a 40-acre plot here in the state that reduced its fertilizer use while trying to maintain maximum yields. Apparently, you were successful. Have there been similar results globally to this kind of experiment?
Well, actually, this if you like to call it a pilot project in Tuscola County in Michigan, was the first of its kind with regards to generating what we call these carbon offsets, these carbon credits from reducing nitrogen in the soil, in this case, a corn system. So these credits that were generated from reducing nitrogen rate, which in turn reduced nitrous oxide, those credits can be sort of traded on the carbon marketplace, the voluntary carbon marketplace in the U.S. at the moment. So actually it was the first of its kind globally to generate these credits from nitrogen management. We hope to, myself and colleagues and others, hope to extend this initiative, this project, to the Midwest and beyond, where obviously corn is grown in very large areas in the U.S. Midwest, but also other areas in the world. So extending this pilot project to larger scales with larger adoption would be obviously beneficial to farmers, the farmers' pockets, because they're reducing the nitrogen rate, but also to their soil quality and their water quality, and hopefully the atmospheric quality as well.
Neville, tell us more about the carbon market. What is it? How does it work?
Right, and basically it's using, in this case, from agriculture. Agriculture is not... quickly want to add, agriculture is not going to be capped with regards to its emissions. That's not occurring at the moment. But how agriculture can contribute to the carbon market is by changing management practices, perhaps, you know, sequestering carbon, or in our case here, reducing nitrous oxide emissions. And those reductions, those offsets that are generated from those practices can be used in a voluntary market currently in the U.S. to offset other producers or other companies who may be emitting more greenhouse gas emissions, or may just want to help green the environment by purchasing these credits to improve the environment. There is a mandatory compliance market which started in California a year or two back, where certain, if you want to call them bigger polluters, have their emissions capped to a certain level, and in order to meet that cap, these polluters can buy certain amounts of these offsets from either agriculture or forestry to help them meet their cap.
Okay.
That's based in California at the moment.
Okay, very good. Neville Miller is a senior research associate here at Michigan State University. Mr. Miller, many thanks.
Thank you, Mike.
This environmental segment of Current State, supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, check out greatlakesecho.org. It's Current State on WKAR. This weekend marks the 50th anniversary of a tragic and historic turning point in the fight for civil rights. The night of June 21, 1964, three young civil rights workers were shot and killed near the community of Philadelphia, Mississippi. They were there organizing and working to register African Americans to vote during 10 violent and controversial weeks remembered as Freedom Summer. Tomorrow night, WKAR-TV looks back a half century with a public preview of part of our upcoming American Experience special, also named Freedom Summer. It'll include a panel discussion with four special Michigan guests who were active in the civil rights movement: Willard Walker, Reverend John Baumgartner, Milton Powell, and Judy Karanjeff. The panel moderator will be former state representative and gubernatorial candidate Lynn Jondal of Okemos, who participated in 1965's Selma to Montgomery March. Yesterday, I spoke with Lynn Jondal. I first asked him to describe the national atmosphere in 1964 regarding civil rights for African Americans.
Well, there were a number of things going on. Generally, there was a growing awareness of the struggle, civil rights struggle, in the South, particularly. There had been busloads of people coming to the South from northern communities to participate in multiple states in voter registration projects, efforts to encourage and get African-Americans to register and vote. So communities all over the country were aware of the struggle going on. When those three young men were first disappeared, and then a period of time while they were looking to find what had happened to them, that became a kind of a daily news item. Why were they there? What had happened? They were there as part of the Freedom Summer and voter registration effort. So there was a good deal of attention riveted on what was going on in the South, but also in communities in the North. There were those stores, for example, Woolworths, which was a store, a kind of five and dime, mm-hmm. that had lunch counters.
Sure.
It's where the buses stopped that were bringing these freedom riders into to the South, because they would not serve those people on the buses. Pickets went up and boycotts in communities all over the country around that chain to bring pressure.
The nation in particular was outraged over the murders of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, and they spurred the federal government into action with the Civil Rights Act signed into law only 10 days after they disappeared. Do you remember your response to that?
We were watching I lived in Los Angeles at the time and worked on a campus there as a campus pastor. And we were watching. It was a regular evening ritual, the news on what was happening. That particular action with those students disappearing, we had colleagues colleagues of mine, who were going regularly to Washington to talk to members of Congress about the need for the Civil Rights Act. And so there was a lot of organizing in various communities to bring political pressure. That particular action did a couple of things. It certainly underscored in people's minds the seriousness of the struggle for civil rights, but also required people in political office to take a stand, because they could no longer pretend or say there wasn't something mm-hmm. going on there. It was mm-hmm. it was a kind of mobilizing thing, and so the question became, what are you going to do about this reality? And it sharpened that focus.
And in 65, you became more directly involved. You participated in the march on Selma, Alabama. I see in the early 60s, the population of Dallas County, where Selma was 57% African-American, but of the 15,000 African-Americans old enough to vote, only 130 were registered. That's fewer than 1%. Can you describe and remember your impressions of the place when you first arrived?
Well, I remember it vividly. There was a church called Brown's Chapel there, where it was kind of the gathering place for the activity, and we met daily for instructions and rallies and training. Once we arrived, we were taken to be introduced to who would be our host family, a local African-American family in a housing development there in Selma.
Mm-hmm.
My introduction to a number of things. I mean, I was introduced to a community, obviously predominantly African-American. I was introduced to whatever it was on their menu for this Iowa kid now in California. I was introduced to grits for the first time. They were our hosts to house us. But then we'd spend each day doing practice demonstrations. We would go perhaps and march around a local school in Selma. We would take small groups and walk down to the city hall to register people there, being turned away on a regular basis. One day in the training, we were, a group of us were arrested by the Selma officials and taken to be booked, and then there were enough of us, they didn't have jail space. They put us in a big building, auditorium overnight, and held us, released the next day. But a great feel of anxiety, let's call it fear, not knowing what was going to happen next, and knowing full well that the situation was extremely volatile.
Freedom Summer is a WKAR-TV's next American Experience special, and tomorrow evening at 7 here at MSU's Communication Arts Building, the public is invited to view part of the movie and share in a roundtable discussion that's that will be moderated by our guest, former State Representative Lynn Jondal. There were actually several marches to get from Selma to Montgomery. There were Bloody Sunday, March 7th. When about 600 marchers were attacked by police with billy clubs and tear gas. Can you describe the march itself? What stands out in your memory?
A couple of kinds of things. One of them was, I remember a youngster who I'm guessing his age to be 7, 8 at the oldest, who local, who said, was walking beside me, and he said, you know, are you afraid? And I said, well, I'm having a bit of anxiety. And he said, I'm not afraid. Dr. King says our love will flow over and affect all these people who are standing there. So I was feeling a little weak compared to my companion there. We were walking down streets that we had a lot of local people screaming at us obscenities and so on as we approached the bridge, where we had seen on TV the previous effort get demolished by law enforcement coming in on horses with clubs and so on. And so that was kind of a
tense moment.
Tense moment, without a doubt. That happened, yeah. You know, there was singing. We were singing freedom songs. There was a sense of spirit. We had learned positions to take if you were attacked, trained in nonviolence, how to essentially protect yourself or fall on someone else to protect them. So it was serious business in that sense, but a highly emotional and uplifting experience with, you know, joining in the process, but surrounded by clear challenge.
Put on your reviewer's hat for us for just a second. Describe what you've seen of the program.
The program is interesting because it rehearses for us. I keep thinking it wasn't very long ago, but you know, kids like you, you know, it was 50 years ago, and. It does rehearse, which seems to me, as I say, not that long ago, a very critical time in our history. And they looked at three things. You saw these kids from colleges and universities all over the country, about 1,000 of them, coming to Mississippi to participate in helping to register African Americans to vote. The kind of figures you were talking about out of Selma and others were just dramatic in that sense, and then others of them teaching in Freedom Schools, which were teaching Black history, teaching a pretty basic curriculum that these African American kids were not exposed to in their school system at that time. And then another part of the film that's very dramatic is the struggle for the Freedom Democrats, a group of a biracial integrated delegation saying, we are the true representatives of the Democratic Party in Mississippi. They went to the convention to challenge the all-white delegation.
Dixiecrats.
Dixiecrats had arrived there. And the film has a very dramatic telling of that story, of their challenge to the Democratic Party, the reaction of the party, including then-President Johnson, his nominee for Vice President Hubert Humphrey, resisting the Freedom Democrats for fear it would split the party and lose the South for the Democrats in the upcoming 64 election. A marvelous telling of that story, which probably is not real well known.
Our guest is Lynn Jondahl. Again, the public will have its chance to view Freedom Summer tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. It is free, but we ask that you visit WKAR.org to reserve your places. Lynn Jondahl will be moderating a panel discussion, including several special guests. So 50 years later, what is the legacy of Freedom Summer, in your view?
Well, we do have, for sure, legislation that came out of that period of time, not alone out of Freedom Summer, but we did have the Civil Rights Act. Now, I would say, unfortunately, we're seeing erosion of some of the provisions in that as recently as a decision of the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. But in fact, it was the marking time of a major significant change. I think particularly focused on the issue of voter registration, which then meant never again were we going to have to fight that same battle to assure that there was racial representation in the conventions and voter registration. Now the figures are substantially different. But having said the positive things, you look at what still is a struggle with the efforts to make it more difficult in many cases for low income, for African-American voters to get to the polls, to register, and so on. So the struggle's not over.
Are you more encouraged or discouraged here 50 years later?
Well, I'm encouraged in that it's such a substantially different world in regard to access to our democratic institutions and so on. But it is discouraging to me that so many of these issues are still being fought in such raw and open kinds of ways that it seems to me 50 years later we ought to be able to take voter participation, registration, and so on for granted, and yet we can't. It's still a struggle.
Our guest has been Lynn Jondahl. Once again, Lynn is the moderator of a panel discussion that will take place tomorrow night here at WKAR-TV, Communication Arts building here surrounding Freedom Summer, the next American Experience special. Lynn Jondahl, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
And a reminder that tomorrow night's event is free, but we ask that you register online beforehand. Please go to WKAR.org. Available seats are going fast. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll learn about the organization Kids Read Comics for our Neighbors in Action segment. Also, we'll explore the sounds of K-pop. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and to Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.